Hi, it's Eric Lors, and you're listening to the Guru Selling System Radio Show. So, even though the economy is looking up, the job figures are looking better, and spending is looking better, we're still a long way from okay. And so there's this hope, obviously, in sales. I mean, when things pick up, that magically sales will pick up. And I will tell you that, from the folks that I've been talking to, sales are slowly picking up, but there's still a lot of hesitancy, and a lot of people, still trying to nickel and dime and trying to use every technique to delay and throw off and everything that they can. And we want to know, obviously, even though things are picking up, we still have to base ourselves or work from the construct of that the economy is down, that people are still in that sort of preservation mode and very nervous mode, et cetera. So they're going to be very hesitant. And the problem, though, that arises from this is obviously if you think that the client you're dealing with is very hesitant, there is that tendency to give them a lot of rope, allow them a lot of things, a lot of time, a lot of this, a lot of, kind of going all over the place and dragging out and taking a long time for sales cycle and all this other stuff. And I don't know if that really works. As a matter of fact, I have come to believe that the exact opposite is true, and that people really, they're looking for solutions, and maybe they actually need a kick in the butt once in a while. But let's not just leave it up to what I think. Let's talk to some other folks, and to that extent and to that end, that's why I invited the authors of the new book, The Challenger Sale, who are Matthew Dixon and Brett Adamson, onto my show. And we'll be getting to that interview in just a moment. As always, I encourage you to stick around all the way through the show and listen in. I'm going to tell you right now, this is far and away one of the best interviews I have done, in a long time. Some really, really good insights came out of this interview, so make sure you listen all the way through so that you can get the most out of it, because I'm going to tell you right now, it kicks butt. Anyway, without further ado, let's get to our interview with Matt Dixon and Brent Adamson. Okay, today our guests are Matthew Dixon and Brent Adamson, and they are the co-authors of the book, The Challenger Sale. Now, Matthew is a managing director with the Corporate Executive Board, and he has overseen dozens of quantitative and qualitative research studies of customer service and sales, and has presented his findings to hundreds of senior executives and management teams around the world, including many Fortune 500 companies. In addition to The Challenger Sale, his work has been published in the Harvard Business Review, and he is also a frequent contributor on sales and customer service topics to Harvard Review's blog, as well as the Sales Executive Council blog and the Customer Contact Council blog. And Brent is also a managing director at the Corporate Executive Board, and he serves as the chief storyteller for both the Sales Executive Council and the Marketing Leadership Council. Brent facilitates a wide range of executive-level discussions around the world with Fortune 500 Global 1000 executives in sales, marketing, and customer service, including multi-company retreats, single-company working sessions, global sales meetings, keynote presentations, board-level presentations, and hands-on best practice workshops. In nearly his 10 years with CEB, he has worked with tens of thousands of sales and marketing leaders all over the world in meetings, seminars, workshops, and retreats to redefine commercial excellence. So, guys, welcome to the show.
Hey, Eric, how you doing?
Hi, Eric. How are you?
Okay. Glad to have you guys. Glad to have you guys. Glad you could make it. All right. So we're going to be talking today, obviously, about the economy. It's, they say there's signs of life, and you know what? I'm hopeful. I got my fingers crossed that, the unemployment numbers and everything is starting to look good, but technically we're still way, way down from where we were. So I want to, I want to talk to you about here in the down economy. So, in your opinion, your guys' opinion, how has the downturn of the economy impacted sales?
Well, Eric, hey, this is Brent Adamson. It's funny about the question about the downturn and sort of its impact on sales. In many ways, if you want to think about it from this perspective, it's been a huge distraction. So and arguably a very dangerous one in our minds, because the story that we're telling in sales, and particularly in the business-to-business world of sales, which is where we spend most of our time, we find that the bigger story by far is actually what's happening in the world of sales irrespective of the economy and not because of it.
What do you mean?
Well, the thing that we're finding is that, if you think about sort of the last 5, 10 to 15 years of business selling, we've all been on a journey of some form or another, moving from sort of product selling to solution selling or value-based selling, whatever you might want to call it, you know, all in a effort to escape the sort of classic trap of commoditization that, you know, individual price-based products sort of delivers. So the question becomes really, you know, how do we morph our organization? How do we go on this long-term transformation towards more of a solutions provider? And, of course, you know, we'll come along right around 2009, the bottom falls out of the economy, makes everything so much harder. But the thing that we've been finding that sort of the down economy is masked is really over the last 3 to 4 to 5 years that as much as we've called the solutions play, our customers in the B2B world have called the solutions counterplay. And arguably, today, the bigger story in sales isn't so much how the world of selling is changing, but actually how the world of buying is changing. And we find that customers today are buying in a fundamentally different way from suppliers than they have in the past. And when you trace back much of those changes, you find that the cause of many of those changes, while certainly exacerbated by the economy, were not actually caused by it. And we think that's an important story to focus on because, yeah, to your point, Eric, you know, that today's economy could be described as maybe sideways at best, but someday the economy will indeed turn around, and we find that when it eventually does, none of the things that make selling hard today probably go away. In fact, they are sort of the new reality for selling. So we find, in that sense, the biggest danger of the down economy is actually more of the fact that it creates sort of a distraction from these longer-term trends that we think companies really do need to be focused on.
So panic is blurring their focus that should be on improvement and changing. And you're saying, it sounds like you're saying that the new reality, which some people are hoping is a temporary reality until the economy comes back, is really selling is not going to, we're not going back to the days of being able to pick up a phone and take an order from, you know, anybody in 5 minutes anymore.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, Eric, this is Matt. I think you put it very well. One of the things that you know, we talk about in the book and that Brent and I spend a lot of time talking to our clients about is sort of the good, bad, and ugly of what's going on in business-to-business selling right now. I think the good news for salespeople and for commercial organizations broadly, so they're including sales and marketing, are things like, you know, the customer's time horizon right now, if you compare it with 2009 is extended beyond help me stay in business for the next 2 weeks, which is really what customers cared about when all they cared about was really cash flow and liquidity and their survival over the next few weeks or maybe few months. Now they're actually open to talking about longer-term solutions and partnerships with suppliers. The other thing I'd say on the good news column is, and one of the things we track pretty closely, is contact turn is actually stabilized. And, of course, that's important for sellers because part of what we do is establish contact and relationships with existing people in customer organizations. And that's not very helpful when those people are not there 2 weeks after you last visited them because they got laid off or they, you know, they were a subject of or an object of right-sizing or downsizing or what have you. So now we're building relationships, and hey, those people are still there when we go back to business. So that's good news. You know, the bad news is, of course, that people aren't spending as much, and they're tremendously risk-averse right now. The price pressure is exorbitant on salespeople. And then I think what Brent was talking about, we'd put in the ugly column. So if you've got the good news and the bad news of selling in today's environment, it's a little bit better than it was in early 2009, I think, to your point in the beginning of the interview here. It's not all roses, though, but there's some ugly things going on right there, you know, that are going on irrespective of the downturn. These are things like customers demanding increased consensus before they pull the trigger on a deal, especially a complex deal. Customers pushing risk back on suppliers, so we're seeing gain sharing and risk sharing contracts in vogue in a way now that they haven't been for a very long time. We are seeing customers bring in third-party consultants to help them negotiate the best deal from suppliers possible. You know, all of these kinds of things in the ugly column, as Brent said, we think are here to stay. And so we think it's a mistake for people to say, boy, these are all just bad things that are a function of the downturn right now, and once things get better, they'll all go away. We think a lot of those things in the ugly column are really here to stay. They are the response by the customer to our efforts to sell more complex solutions. They basically push back, and this is the way they push back. And so companies have to prepare for that as a long-term shift in how they sell.
Well, that's just kind of a downer, man.
Yeah. So, Eric actually does. Let me make the glass half full, because it's a good point. Again, this is Brent. Because I ran this riff with a head of sales and marketing, a big manufacturing company, about a year ago, and we called it the ugly, partly just to poke the bear, be provocative. But the thing he said was really interesting to me. He said, you know, Brent, I wouldn't call that the ugly. I'd call that our strategy. He said, you know, to the degree to which we as a company can do a better job than anyone else of finding and building that consensus, identifying that wide range of customer stakeholders that we need to tap into and do a better job of tailoring our message to each one of those individuals, the degree to which we can actually build risk into our value proposition. So part of buying from us over anyone else is that we can take risk off your plate. The degree to which we can find ways to customize that feel custom to you, our customer, but don't break the bank on our side, that's how we're going to win. But so it doesn't necessarily have to be a negative picture, but it is, in fact, a new reality we believe that we're selling into going forward.
So, it sounds like, and I, you know, trust me, I've been hearing the stories, and I have a colleague who had a painfully bad story along that lines. But, well, they negotiated a $50 million deal, got down to the closing table, at which point the client turned around and said, okay, we want you to buy all of the hardware. It's for IT service. We want you to buy it, host it, and maintain it for us, which had been not discussed up until which automatically took $25 million of value out of a $50 million and put all the risk on them. So it sounds like, this really goes beyond the sales department, though. You're talking about literally having to change the way a company does business, not just what the salesperson can offer.
Well, you know, it's absolutely right. In fact, we talk about this some in the book, and we certainly are happy to get into it in more detail as we get into the conversation. But while much of our work at the Sales Executive Council is sort of first and foremost positioned as a story of what individual sales professionals can do when they're sitting at that table across from the customer, looking them in the eye and asking them for their business. But the story doesn't really start or end there. We find that really the stories that we're working on with our clients around the world are much less about individual skill alone and much more about organizational capability. They are stories of organizational transformation. So as we get into this challenger story a little bit, that's what we find is that to build challenger reps, you really need to build the challenger organization that's capable of delivering to customers really what they're looking for in this world of complex solution selling. Again, to go back to where we started, all of this is certainly exacerbated by a down economy, but we don't think it's driven by it. So again, this is sort of the new reality of what we need to be thinking about going forward.
Now, you were referring to the challenger methodology. So why don't you delve into that a little bit, and how does that methodology play into what we're talking about today?
Yeah, sure. Let me back up here to give you a little bit of sense of the work and where it came from. So we've Sales Executive Council is a member-driven organization. We serve roughly 400 sales organizations around the world, and we're research organizations. So we basically take our marching orders from our members. Back in late 2008, when we were starting to go into our annual research planning cycle for the research we'd present across 2009, the question that we got from our members, and remember, late 2008 was a pretty harrowing time to be a head of sales in any industry, and our members came to us with this problem of, help me solve a mystery, and the mystery is this, that everybody in my sales organization is missing quota by, in some cases, miles, but there are still a handful of high performers who are hitting their numbers, in fact, in some cases, quitting their number, bringing in the kind of business that everyone else can only dream about. We're seeing this gap widen and widen between the core performers and the performers. And while this has arguably always been the question in sales is what is it that differentiates high performers from average performers, never was there a more pressing time from our members' perspective to actually bring insight to that conversation, to really understand it, to identify what are the things that the high performers are doing that we could actually bottle and export to everybody else and thereby sort of lift all boats, if you will. And so we started our research in the fall of 2008. I've now gone out, and I think by last count, we've surveyed upwards of 12,000 salespeople around the world across every major geography and industry out there ran a survey without going into too much depth about the methodologies. A lot more there in the book if you care to learn more about the methodology. But ran a study to really try to understand what are the things that high performers are doing that are different. And I'll tell you, the first thing that came out of that is that of all the variables we tested, they all actually fell cleanly into what we call the five profiles of sales reps. They are the relationship builder, the challenger, the hard worker, the reactive problem solver, and the lone wolf. So we've got five different profiles of salespeople. These are really proxies for salesperson behavior, and the truth is across the thousands of people in our survey, we can actually say that every single salesperson falls cleanly into one of those five different profiles. We think of them as sort of the majors of sales university. So while they're not mutually exclusive and there's a bit of overlap one to the other, so for example, it's not to suggest that your challenge that they can't build relationships. In fact, they do. They just happen to major in challenging. So there's some overlap there, but again, much to our surprise, and it was a very powerful kind of framework for heads of sales to actually know that all of your salespeople kind of major in one of these five types of ways of facing off with the customer or approaching their job as salesperson. The second big aha that came out of that research is that not only are there five types of salespeople, but when you look at how these profiles perform, it's quite eye-opening. So if you look at average performing salespeople, what you actually find is that there's pretty even distribution across these five profiles. In other words, there are basically five ways to be average in sales. But when you look at high performers, what you find is that there's one profile that dominates the rest, and that's the challenger profile. The challenger, we can get into this as we get into the conversation a little bit and who these people are and what makes them tick. But challenger came in at roughly 40% of all high-performing salespeople. And as surprising as it was to learn the challenger wins, as surprising as that was that the relationship builder comes in dead last at only 7% of high-performing salespeople. And ironically, this is the profile that most professional sales organizations have really placed the biggest bet on. So it's the one that they tend to recruit for. It's the one that they reward and they try to cultivate internally. These are the people who get the sales management jobs and get promoted to higher levels in the organization. It's been the culture we've tried to build in sales for years and years and years. And what we find, again, is that we've placed our biggest bet on the profile, for the most part, least likely to succeed. The third big takeaway from the research is that this is not a function, to Brent's comments earlier, not a function of the down economy. When we cut the data by sales complexity, what we actually find is that when you look at the shift from low-complexity product selling to high-complexity solution selling, and you isolate only high-complexity solution selling environments, challengers dominate by an even greater order of magnitude. Challengers actually come in at 54% of high performers in a complex solution selling environment. So for any company on a journey from selling products to selling solutions, and I think for most B2B companies that's generally descriptive of the journey that they're on, you can't avoid the story that, you know, you've got to build a challenger capability in your sales force. And incidentally, when you look at complex solution selling environments, relationship builders fall off the map almost entirely at only 4% of all high performers there. So those are the three big takeaways: five types of reps, challengers win, relationship builders lose, and that this becomes even more exacerbated in highly complex selling environments.
Can you synopsize what the attributes of a challenger salesperson are?
Sure. The thing is, when you go back and you look at the data, and you really try to understand what sets these challengers apart, you know, first of all, as Matt mentioned, there's sort of a baseline level of performance across all reps, irrespective of profile. You know, to some degree or another, every rep has some business acumen. To some degree or another, every rep has adheres to the sales process, is willing to risk disapproval, et cetera. But when you look at these challengers specifically and look at what sets them apart, what makes them different, it really boils down to three sort of high-level competencies. Again, a lot more detail in the book around this, but it's essentially their ability to do three things, as we like to call it: teach, tailor, and take control. And to kind of go back and go through each one of these just briefly, teaching is a really important one. It's fundamentally important to this entire challenger story, which is we find the very best sales reps have got an incredibly strong ability to approach customer conversations with insight, with new ideas, not about their products and solutions, which is, of course, how we're all trained. We're all trained in product selling and features and benefits and, you know, talking about our new XP9100 and how it does everything 3 seconds faster. But the very best sales reps aren't, ironically, talking about their solutions at all, at least not initially. What they're doing is they're talking to customers about the customer's business and showing them new ways to make money or save money or penetrate new markets or mitigate risk. in ways those customers themselves had never fully realized were even possible. So this is far beyond sales 101 of asking your customer lots of questions to identify their needs. This is actually going in and educating customers on what their needs actually are in ways they had themselves not realized. And by the way, one of the things we have a huge amount of customer survey behind this too, and we look at it from the customer's angle, and we ask, what are you looking for in a supplier? Interestingly, the number one thing customers are looking for in a supplier is not world-class product, service, or brand, because they kind of know from a number of different sources, looking for someone to teach them. So two completely different surveys, a customer survey, a rep survey, and we find that this insight idea, this ability to teach, is at the center of both. So that's challenger, and that's just the first of three. So challenger ability number one is the ability to teach customers something new about their business. The second thing is we find about challengers is their ability to do that in a very tailored fashion. So it stands to reason if we live in this world of the consensus-based sale where you've got to talk to more and more customer stakeholders than ever before to get the deal done, the sales reps most likely to win in that world are the ones that can tailor that approach, not from company to company or industry to industry, but actually person to person. If I'm sitting down talking to a head of marketing versus a head of IT versus a purchaser versus a procurement officer versus a business owner, an end user, what do those individuals care about? What are they on the hook to deliver for their company? What are the metrics that they're measured on? And the very best sales rep can tailor their teaching to those individuals and the economics of that company's business. So how they make money, how they save money. I can understand all that and approach them with some very tailored insight. And then finally, Eric, the third one of teach, tailor, take control, this question about taking control is really interesting to us because it's the one that's raised the most eyebrows in the world of selling, right? Because we all in the sales have the tough reputation of, you know, used car sales guy, the pushy sim, and the arrogant guy. And so we want to make sure that when we talk about taking control, it's not that. It's not be annoying or be aggressive. But at the same time, we find the very best sales reps have got this willingness and ability to create a certain amount of what we've come to call constructive tension as part of the sale. Because, and really across two dimensions, it stands to reason if you want to, in terms of insight, if you're going to teach customers something new about their business, the first thing they're all going to say to you is, we're different. That doesn't apply to us. Because you hear that from every customer, right? But challenger reps are willing and able, with respect, with professionalism, with empathy, to look that customer in the eye and say, you know, it's funny, we've come to appreciate those differences over time, but let me walk you through a couple of these insights because we find that they can apply to you in some really surprising ways. And with your permission, I'd love to get a sense from, you know, I'd love to work through some of these with you and get a sense for how we think they might apply. So again, you do it professionally and respectfully, but you push back on the customer around the insight. And the other way that we find that challengers take control is not just on the insight side, but on the commercial side. So when that customer looks you in the eye and asks for that 5% discount, you know, a relationship builder gets stuck in negotiating around, is it 3% or is it 5%?
But
maybe it's 6. That's right. Give them 6. It'll keep them happy. But a challenger rep will take price off the table altogether and say something like, you know, let's set price aside, and we'll come back to that because we have to figure that out. But let's make sure we have agreement on the value of this relationship first. So they're always looking to bring that conversation back to value. So when you ask, you know, what makes someone a challenger rep, it's these behaviors, these skills around teaching, tailoring, and taking control. And again, what's neat about all this is that it's not just sort of pure assertion. That's exactly what came out of thousands and thousands and thousands of data points from all over the world. You know, whether you're talking about Japan or the Bronx or Dubai, we find that, you know, of course, the way you do that is always in the culture, the context of the culture you're in, but it's always this ability to do those three things, teach, tailor, and take control.
Well, and I agree. A lot of what you're saying runs along the same theories and tactics I teach my clients. I'm curious, what, because of the fear inherent in the market right now in the marketplace, because, you know, people are with their, you know, creating 10-person decision-making teams and all this other garbage. Do you find any sort of pushback to the challenger, or is that, especially the first part about expanding their horizons, as it were? Do you find that overcomes any sort of, you know, so because you said, you know, there's sort of that part where it's like, I'm going to show you the dream, you know, which is, you know, how you can increase your business, but I'm also going to put, you know, when you say you're different and special, you know, I'll be polite, but I'm going to basically call you on the mat on that one. Do you think that it's the sort of dreamer half that says, here's all the stuff that's going to happen and that you don't even have to worry about the economy anymore because we're going to help you increase your business to this degree that allows also for that other half of but I'm also going to, you know, cut out your fantasy of being different and special from everybody else.
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. Let me make sure I'm answering here. There's a number of sort of thoughts I have about that. The one I think is, you know, you hit the nail on the head. I think the term fear really does sort of capture very well what salespeople feel like they get what they're sensing from the customer side. And I think the way we would interpret that is more as customer risk aversion. I think that some of that's still short term in nature. So I think there's a heightened, as we talked about before, there's this risk aversion has been exacerbated certainly by the downturn. And I don't think anybody is likely to stick their neck out for a supplier. So, you know, gone are the days of finding your way to the corner office and finding the decision maker and walking out with a signed deal. And like you said, more often than not, especially selling complex solutions, we're looking at 10-person, if not more, decision-making bodies. And so, and of course, the likelihood that one of those people is going to raise an objection, perhaps one of those people prefers the competitor or the other supplier's offerings, or perhaps one of the people on that buying committee actually came up with the status quo in the first place and doesn't want to be associated with changing course, goes up dramatically, you know, when you're dealing with more than one person there. But I think the risk aversion as well is long-term in nature. And really, when we think about it, I think one of the conversations we often have here is, and I think going back to the first thing you said around pushback around the challenger model, I mean, I think the general, a lot of that is couched in this fear of, if you will, revoking or abdicating the relationship, I think, with the customer. And so there's a lot of conversation that we have with our clients and with people who've read the book who come back and say, you know, it takes a bit of a leap of faith to actually go out and challenge the customer, to call them to the mat, to use your term. And are we worried that, you know, we are somehow losing something good that comes from having a relationship with the customer? And really what that comes down to is, don't relationships still matter to sales? And what does this really mean? And is this hell bent for leather kind of approach around challenger, and we're therefore saying that relationships don't matter? And I think the reality is, if you look at the research, read the book, if you talk to any salesperson, especially salespeople who get this challenger notion, this challenger approach, I think you get universal agreement with the statement that relationships still very much matter to sales. They are a core to business-to-business selling, especially complex solution selling. The data backs that up, so I could tell you that challengers actually minor in relationship building. They major in challenging, they minor in relationship building. And really the difference between the challenger and the relationship builder is one of posture. The relationship builder uses the relationship as an end unto itself. They believe that by having a good relationship with the customer, business will follow. The challenger, though, uses the relationship to get in the door with the customer and then push their thinking. Now, of course, if they don't have a relationship with the customer, if the customer just doesn't like them, that's a bigger problem, and they got to fix that. But they don't stop there. They use it as a means to an end, not as an end unto itself. And it kind of makes sense when you think about either selling in the downturn or selling complex, risky solutions, and come back to this fear and risk aversion we're talking about before. You know, the relationship builder's posture is, hey, whatever you need, I got you covered. I'm your guy. And that's not a very effective way to sell anything when customers are in fear mode, when they're avoiding risk big time right now because of the down economy, and generally when they're wanting to avoid risk around complex solutions. What the customer really wants is to stick with the status quo, to hunker down, to spend more time thinking about it. And to sell something, to sell a complex solution, to sell in a tough economy, you've actually got to push the customer outside their comfort zone. So that's why the challenger succeeds there, because they're selling successfully when disruption is really what's required, when it's required by dint of a down economy, or frankly by the fact that you're trying to sell something, a complex solution that is disruptive to the way they do things right now. That's why challengers win, because they actually run at that risk aversion and run at that fear.
I often tell my clients, I say, that at this point in time, this is when real sales leadership comes in. It's a lot of times people hear sales leadership and they think, you know, whoever the big dog is, and he's sort of the captain of the sales team or something like that. And I say what clients are, especially in fear mode, is they're looking for a leader. Because they don't like their current situation. Yeah. But since nobody's standing up on the deck, you know, at the steering wheel right now, because like you said, they're hunkered down below deck. They're looking for a leader, and the leader has to come on in and do two things. Number one, the leader, because I would say people's biggest problem is they don't know what their biggest problem is, which is a lot of times you get into that situation where when you put together a group of people who shouldn't be making a decision together, they kind of come up with a decision like, well, this is what we want, even though it's a solution to a problem that doesn't actually exist for any of the organization, and that's why it never gets bought, or it gets bought at the cheapest price and never used. So they're kind of looking for somebody to come in and first, you know, blow apart the problem they think they have and help them get to the real problem, and then to blow apart the solution they thought they wanted and show them the real solution. Are those aspects of the challenger that you have found?
Yeah, I think
I think you've nailed it, Eric, in a lot of ways. You know, what's interesting about this, by the way, is when you do that well, it does not mean you have to reinvent the solutions you're ultimately trying to sell. This is a story not about what you sell, but of how you sell. So the idea is, once you've got a good sense of the solution you're trying to lead the customer to value, the only way to get them to value it is not to go out and talk about how great the solution is, which is, by the way, what we're all trained to do, but it is to do exactly what you're talking about, is to go in and reframe the way they're currently thinking of their situation and saying, here's a different way of thinking about it altogether, and here's why it matters to think this way, not that way. Here's what's at stake for you as a company, the money you're losing, the revenue you're foregoing by thinking about it like this as opposed to like that. So build an ROI, not on buying our solution, but build an ROI for changing your thinking, and then show them the set of behaviors that they would need to pursue to implement that solution. What would you need to be able to do in order to realize that kind of benefit? Well, you need to be able to do this, 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 and this. Got it. All right, so we all agree on that. One, that this is a different way of thinking about it. Two, it's worth it to think that different way. And three, here's the way you can actually enact a solution around that new way of thinking. And if you get them there, and that's all of that's happened before really what we traditionally call selling has ever begun, right? Because at that point, they're going to look at you and say, wow, you're right. Who can help me with that? And it's that magic moment where you got to be able to look them in the eye and say, let me show you how we can help you with that better than anyone else. But generally, that's where we start the conversation. We come in saying, let me show you how we can help you better than anyone else. And they'll say, yeah, but that's not the solution we're trying. That's not the problem we're trying to solve. We're talking about this, and you're over here talking about something to solve that. So before you can talk about your solution and get people excited about your solution, you have to bring them to the party. Because to your point, they're on a completely different party, and it's arguably the wrong one. So you got to show them why their thinking is incorrect. And of course, again, with respect, you don't want to be disrespectful or arrogant or anything like that, but you've got to challenge their thinking, show them a different way of thinking, show them why it's worth it to think that new way, what they would have to do to essentially implement or enact that thinking, and then show them how you, the supplier, can help. So rather than a conversation that leads with everything that you do, you got to start you have to run a conversation that leads to everything that you do. We call the shift from lead with to lead to. So start with insight, but make sure that insight leads ultimately to something you do better than anyone else.
So we probably got a lot of sales people, sales managers, sales VPs listening in, and you know the odd solo consultants. These tend to be the people who listen to the show. So there's probably a number of them sitting out there saying, okay, and they're looking at themselves and they're saying, you know, right now, some of them are sitting there and going, "Hey, I realize I'm a challenger. Hooray! I'm good." But there's people out there saying, "You know, I'm realizing I'm the relationship builder. I'm the techno guy. I'm, you know, all that kind of stuff." Is it possible to make the shift easily? Because you know, it's one thing to say, "Well, look, you know, you know, here's a list of questions." But as we all know, when you give people a script, it comes out robotic. Is there a natural way, that people can change how they perceive, or what are the elements that they need to change, either in self-perception or in their perception of sales, that can move them over naturally to being a challenger salesperson, if that's even possible?
Yeah, it's a great question. The thing we would say is, so first of all, we have a discussion a lot, Brent and I do, with the whole nature-nurture discussion. And to some level, I mean, it's almost an irrelevant question we tell heads of sales because, you know, there are people out there who are probably natural-born challengers. And if you have open headcount, if you are ideally you're in growth mode and you're expanding your sales force, by all means, go out and look for challengers. It's cheaper and easier to buy rather than to build. And so we've helped companies with challenger hiring guides and things of that nature. But, you know, for the rest of your sales force, we firmly believe, and experience would show, that the vast majority, upwards of 70-80% for most sales organizations, the vast majority of salespeople can get there even if right now they would self-diagnose, or to your point, as not a challenger profile. So, for example, somebody looks at the data, they go through one of our diagnostics, for example, and they see, hey, I'm more of a relationship builder. Well, there's good news there regardless. And the first piece of good news I would say is that there is overlap in all of these profiles. So it's not all one or the other. So you may be a relationship builder, but you understand and you have some of the challenger genome as well. You just need to learn how to flex those muscles when in front of the customer. How does that happen? Well, a few different things. One is the right training and then the right coaching from frontline sales managers to reinforce the right behaviors, the right challenger behaviors, and teach you how to use those muscles that maybe you haven't flexed because you're more grooved to a relationship style of selling. The other thing, though, and just to go back to what we said earlier, is the role of the organization in producing teachable insights and then packaging those insights into what we call teaching pitches, teaching sales pitches, which are designed to lead to your unique benefits. You know, that's really the job of the company. I think that's actually, in many respects, what sets this this challenger notion apart. It is, on the one hand, the story of what salespeople can do differently. And a lot of the story, if you read the book, is about how do we teach our salespeople through training, new types of training and coaching, to exhibit and use those challenger skills and those challenger behaviors in front of the customer. But as much of the story is really on the shoulders of the organization, because it's about identifying what is it that makes us really unique, how do we lead our customers to those unique things, and then put that all in a story that the average salespeople can tell to the customer. You know, and so with the right tools, the right training, the right coaching, we've seen organizations successfully migrate the vast majority of their salespeople to that challenger profile. The ones who don't make it, frankly, are the ones who reject the notion really for will reasons, not for skill reasons. So it's they look at it and they say, hey, that's not that. I've been successful as this kind of salesperson. I'm not comfortable with the notion of pushing customers outside their comfort zone. I don't want to go that route. And so they kind of put their hands up and say, that's really not what I signed up for. And we do see that happen, but for the majority of sales reps, they successfully cross that chasm.
Yeah, I think the latter you were talking about, I qualify those as wussies. No, I'm just kidding.
Right.
So I'm never listening to the show again. I got to admit, I'm sitting here and I'm like, I could have a five-hour conversation with you guys just on this piece, but we are running on time here. So what, one or two or three takeaways, what would you say are the key things that you would want the listeners to take away from, you know, what we've been discussing today?
Well, Eric, I guess there's a couple. So one, starting back to the conversation, where we started the conversation, is that we think by far the bigger story in B2B selling today is not the economy, but rather the long-term shifts, in particularly in customer buying behavior, that are going to have huge implications for how we sell going forward, irrespective of economic performance. That's part one. Part two is that when you go out and you study, and this is something we only mentioned briefly, but when we go out and you study sort of what customers are looking for in this world, there's all sorts of, we started with all sorts of reasons why they won't buy or why they'll buy more slowly and buy less and at a price, you know,
the
depressing story we started with, right? But the thing that I think, the second thing I would focus on is what are they looking for? What's the number one thing that sets the best suppliers apart in this world? And we find the simple word insight, it really captures that differentiator. That's where customers see more difference from one supplier versus another than product, brand, service. It's the quality of the insight that supplier delivers as part of the sale itself. So that's two. And then the third one is that if you ask yourself, as a sales professional, what kind of sales professional do I need to be to deliver that kind of sales experience that customers are looking for? It is this idea of a challenger rep, the rep that's able to go out and, again, diplomatically, empathetically, professionally challenge customers to think differently, show them new ways, not of thinking of their products and solutions, but thinking, helping customers think differently about their own business, new ways to save and make money they didn't realize. And then finally, the fourth point would be, and to get there, to equip reps to challenge in that kind of environment, it's going to take not just a boost in individual skill, but organizational capability. And it's arguably, at the end of the day, what we find is you got to build is not challenger reps, but a challenger organization to deliver what customers are really looking for, which is insight.
Okay. So how can our listeners learn more about you guys, get in touch with you, et cetera?
Sure. So a couple of different ways. Our company is the Corporate Executive Board, which is at www.executiveboard.com. And you can find out more about the Sales Executive Council, which is the program that Brent and I work with as well as our marketing program, the Marketing Leadership Council, and all the other councils and research offerings from our company that cover every functional area, frankly, in the large organization. And then also, if you want to learn more about the book and download some free tools, including that Challenger hiring guide I mentioned only briefly earlier in the interview, go to thechallengersale.com. So it's, again, www.thechallengersale.com. And can learn out more about our organization, download some free tools, videos, podcasts, and some fun stuff like that.
And that, in fact, is the title of the book as well, Eric, is the Challenger Sale, which is, you know, like any good books out there in e-format, book, audio, and now Korean, too, we've just been told. So that, if you want the Korean version, that's available, too, as well.
That's always the one I pick up.
Among a number of other languages, we're quickly selling the international rights. But it's the word's getting out. The book is selling really, really well. We're very excited about it, partly because we think it really captures a very different perspective on B2B selling, which is, one, it's data-driven, and two, really captures this counterintuitive concept of, by, you know, it's not just going out and asking your customers what you need, but going out and teaching your customers what they need. And that's really caught fire around the world as a very different way to differentiate yourself in the marketplace by approaching customers very differently.
Well, I think it's all good. It sounds great to me, and I agree with everything you guys have said. Like I said, it falls right in line with, you know, and not that I'm against other people's opinions, but it's nice when people say, "Hey, Eric, the stuff that we're teaching is exactly like what you teach." So it always makes me feel better.
Yeah, that's why we're interested in talking to you. So we appreciate your interest. I think we found as well folks like yourself and others that I know you've interviewed a lot of kindred spirits out there, and this is sort of thematically consistent with where I think a lot of sort of sales thought leaders have been for some time in terms of what they've been telling their customers they need to do in terms of adapting their sales approach.
Yeah, I think it's great. Well, guys, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, Eric. Cheers.
Thank you, Eric.
Take care. And thank you for taking the time to listen today. Now, after hearing all this, obviously, hopefully, you want to go out and pick up the new book, The Challenger Sale, by Matt and Brent, and definitely I recommend you do that. Also, I definitely recommend that you go and check out Be Do Sell, that is the Guru Selling System book, and you can check that out at bedosale.com, that's bedosale.com. And the reason I recommend that is because if you go to Chapter 10 in the book, we also cover the same kind of ground. The chapter is called Be Inspirational, but definitely the part that you should be checking out is The Undiscovered Country, which is a part of Chapter 10. Obviously, the whole book builds up to being able to do Chapter 10, to be able to confront your clients and respectfully, and also build on their dreams, build on what they desire, and to create a new vision for them. There's a lot of material in the book to help you do that. And you can go on over to bedosale.com and download the first three chapters for free and check it out for yourself. So again, bedosale.com, bedosale.com. Anyway, this is Eric Lewis saying thanks again for taking the time to listen, and always remember, you got to be a person before you can be a salesperson. Take care. Bye-bye.